supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and believe it or not, coming up later in the show, we will take another look at grass clippings. Is it possible that they can be used as a mulch? Am I going to change my mind about grass clippings after all these years? Stay tuned. You won't want to miss it. And you won't, because it's coming up after all of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lois, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
I am just ducky, Lois. Thank you for asking. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
And where is Lois all right?
I am in the Cobbs Creek neighborhood of Philadelphia.
Very good. That's where our friend Kenny Queter grew up. What can we do for you?
So I've been living in the city for 10 years. Grown tomatoes in containers for 10 years, and this is the first year where my tomatoes are sad. They're spindly, they haven't filled out, and although the growth that's coming up looks really healthy, they're just tiny, and I'm not going to get a good harvest.
Okay. Are these the same containers you've been using year after year?
So two of them are, and two of them are new containers this year with new soil.
Okay, good. How big are the containers?
Three of them are 24-inch containers, and one is probably like 18 inches.
That's excellent. What do you fill them with?
The two old containers, I don't even know what kind of soil was in them. But then two new ones, I just went to Home Depot and bought like an organic potting soil.
Okay. Did it have a lot of perlite in it? Could you see the little white balls and stuff like that?
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of perlite in it, no.
Okay. Have you fed them anything?
I don't usually feed them, but when they started to look really sad and they weren't growing like I expected, I did feed them some fertilizer I have for my indoor plants. It's like a 10, 15, 10 fertilizer.
Okay. It's not the worst numbers I've ever heard.
What
I'm going to suggest is there are a couple of good liquid organic plant foods that have come on the market in the last couple of years. You might find them at a big box store, but you're certain to find them at a local independent garden center. Your numbers aren't crazy there, but that's too much nitrogen. Don't forget that indoor house plants aren't flowering plants.
Right.
So they're going to want a lot of nitrogen. You give tomatoes a lot of nitrogen, it'll inhibit flowering, but it should not decrease the size of the plant. So are they getting good sun?
They're on my front patio, which faces south. They get full sun all day.
Okay. The only thing I can think of is it does sound like they're underfed. And if the plants themselves are healthy, if there's no massive yellowing of the lower leaves, then there's no reason to believe that you can't salvage that this season. What kind of tomatoes, though? Are they things like Early Girl, or are they long-season tomatoes like Brandywine?
They're all indeterminate grape tomato or cherry tomato plants. Two of the Napa grape and a Husky cherry red.
Oh, my God. You can't grow cherry tomatoes. You lose. You lose.
I know.
You're the Jamaican bobsled team, honey.
I usually only grow the cherries because the big ones are hard to, you know, get anything in the city.
Yeah. No, that's very reasonable. There's almost no reason for what's happening here. If you got good sun, watering has not been much of an issue this year, especially in containers that size.
Right.
The containers have good drainage?
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to say go out and get a nice liquid soluble plant food. Espoma, the people who help underwrite the show, they have a nice line. There's also a product I really like from another company called Neptune's Harvest, and they have a combination fish and seaweed fertilizer. They're both really good. And the reason I want you to use a liquid fertilizer is we're kind of deep into the season.
Right.
And you want it to be bioactivated as quickly as possible.
Okay.
So that's the only thing I can suggest. Otherwise, I mean, I can't see anything you're totally doing wrong. And if the plants look okay but kind of skinny, I mean, that to me seems like lack of light, though. Leggy plants is definitely lack of sunshine. So give them a little food and see if they perk up. I will not be surprised if they do.
Okay. And you said the one that I gave them had too much nitrogen. So what are the numbers I should be looking for?
The perfect combination is a ratio of 3-1-2. So like a 6-2-4. Recently, to say organic on the label, a plant food has to be certified as truly organic. So if you buy an organic plant food, if you have options, make sure you get the one for flowering plants.
Very good. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Lois.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too.
John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you, Mike. It's John in Rehoboth Beach. Mike, just a fast question. I'm going to be planting some arborvitaes and dwarf Alberta spruce. Should I just dig a bigger hole? Should I add peat moss like when I plant them? And then how much should they be watered, you know, the arborvitae?
Okay, so you're in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware.
Yeah.
Which is just absolutely beautiful. I love that whole stretch of the eastern shoreline right there. How far are you from the ocean?
3 miles.
Okay, so you're kind of inland.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I just need some privacy, and I'm going to get these big arborvitaes. They're 7 foot tall.
Okay, so they're already 7 feet tall.
Yeah, they're already 7 foot tall. They're like $75 a piece, you know?
Well, that's not a bad price for a plant that size.
No, and I'm going to get maybe 10 of them, you know?
Okay, and you don't really have deer problems in your area, do you?
No deer problem.
Okay, now, when are you thinking about installing them? Because right now we're in the middle of summer, and that would be death.
I was thinking like after Labor Day, Mike, maybe
yes.
Late September. Is that good?
That's the absolute best time to plant a tree.
Okay.
Now, you know, I'm going to ask this because you're in essentially still a beachfront community. Is your soil sandy or is it clay?
It's clay. It's pretty good.
Well, pretty good in the sense that it doesn't dry out quickly.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Okay. So here's the deal. If you are planting these evergreens for privacy, do not make a straight line.
Oh, okay.
Imagine a set of bowling pins, 10 pins.
Yes.
And how they're arranged on the end of the alley.
Like staggered, right?
That's exactly what you want to do, because I will guarantee you, if you plant 10 arborvitae in a straight line, number 5 always dies.
Oh, okay.
And then you can never match the shape and the size. But if you stagger them, there's a bigger distance between plants, but the privacy is actually improved. It looks better. It looks more natural.
How many feet apart?
I would defer to the professionals there. I have seen these arborvitae, these giant column-shaped trees, planted pretty close together. My preference would always be to separate them by probably the height of the tree at planting time, say 7 or 8 feet apart.
Okay.
But then have another line of trees covering that opening in front of them.
Oh, okay. I got you.
So you've really got a better barrier, but you've got a healthier situation for the trees.
Right, and it's greater privacy that way, too.
Exactly. Much better for sound, especially.
And, Mike, do I dig a hole, like a hole bigger than the trunk, and then what, should I put peat moss in there?
Nope. You dig a wide hole, but not a deep one. These are going to be bald and burlapped almost certainly, right?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. So you want to remove the burlap, and no matter what anybody tells you, do not put it in the planting hole.
Okay.
Get rid of any wire cages. Get rid of any plastic down around the roots.
Okay.
And then you want to plant the trees higher rather than deeper. Arborvitae are pretty popsicle-like to begin with, but if you can see the root flare, you want that root flare to be above ground. But the trees will stay in the ground better if they're planted high than if they're planted deeply.
Oh, okay.
Because if you plant them deeply, you wind up covering a layer of bark, and that will rot. So you dig a wide hole, but not a deep one. You put the tree in it, and then you refill that hole with the native soil you took out. No added amendments. Because if you make a nice little nursery around the root ball, those roots are going to stay in that nice little island of good soil. You want them to grow out into your clay. So if they're already in clay, they're not going to sense any kind of disturbance when they go out into the soil you didn't dig. And then when you're all done, mulch the plants with a nice inch of compost. And then, yes, watering is key. You want to get a rain gauge when you get these trees. When you plant them a couple at a time, let a hose drip at the base of the tree for like 24 hours, just like an annoying faucet drip.
Yeah.
Really saturate the soil. If you want to get them all in the ground at the same time, invest in a soaker hose where you can hook it up to your garden hose and it'll drip around a wide area.
Oh, okay.
And just let that saturate the ground for 24 hours. And then if we get a hot spell or something like that, repeat that every third day. But if the weather is cooling off, just keep an eye on things, and maybe every fifth day if you don't get rain. But if you get an inch of rain, you don't have to do anything. And then over the winter, the trees should be fine. But in the spring, when everything starts to wake up again, you want to be ready to repeat that watering regimen. You want to be ready to give them an inch of water every week. We don't get rain for the first year of their life in the ground.
Okay.
Lack of water early on is the biggest cause of lost trees. No fertilizer, no wood mulch, nothing to interfere with them getting nicely established.
Okay, Mike, have a great day.
Good luck, John.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will speak at the American Birding Expo in Oaks, PA on Saturday, September 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with scientific questions about grass clippings and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, for over 19 years, I have been telling you not to collect your grass clippings, not to use them in the compost, not to use them as mulch. Today, in the question of the week, we will revisit this opinion. Will I change my mind? Inquiring minds want to know, and they'll find out after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Judy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judy. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well.
And Judy is pretty well in?
Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania.
Very
good. The
Delaware
County part.
All right. What can we do for Judy in Bryn Mawr?
Well, I am told I have Japanese ash beetles attacking my trees.
Mm.
And I had a tree guy come out, and he says I need to have a lot of my trees taken down. And he also is treating some of them, hopefully to save them.
Okay. So how many trees, like, on your property, roughly?
Probably about 12, maybe, left.
Okay. Left. So that means your trees have been dying off?
Well, no. I had two black walnuts taken down. Or black walnuts? Black.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they make these things for... I couldn't stand the droppings.
When I first moved into my house where we live now, the first summer I was out in the garden and I thought kids were in the woods throwing rocks at me.
Ah.
And it was the black walnuts dropping. They are pestiferous. All right. So, and do you know that the trees being affected in your landscape are ash trees?
That's what he said.
Yeah.
The tree man.
And to your eye, the ones that he says are too far gone, do they look bad? Do they look dead? Did they leaf out at all?
Well, so part of them do look dead.
So here's what happens. The emerald ash borer is an imported pest that only showed up maybe a decade ago from China. It came over in packing crates, wooden packing crates.
Ah.
And it's a small beetle. It's beautiful. It's metallic green in color. Again, not that big. In the spring, the adult beetles, who have proliferated in this country unbelievably, in the spring, the adult beetles feed on the leaves of the tree high up in the canopy. And the fact that, you know, they were feeding so much that you were getting, you know, tree schmutz down on your deck or whatever, that shows a huge infestation, or is at least a symptom of a huge infestation. Then the adults mate. They're up there eating and mating, just like Japanese beetles. Mm-hmm. And they lay their eggs underneath the bark, and then tiny little larvae that look like caterpillars tunnel all through the bark. But they don't go straight in. They make these intricate galleries up and down. And so much so that it's like the tree is girdled. They actually create totally dead areas around the tree. And when that happens, the tree can't transport water and nutrients back and forth from the roots to the canopy, and the tree dies. My friend Adrian Higgins at the Washington Post, I recently read a story he wrote where he talked about this, and that the death toll of ash trees in America is in the multi-millions. It's
wow.
Just an enormous number, and they're beautiful trees. The wood is very useful. It had been the premium wood for making Major League Baseball bats because it's strong but light. But this has happened before in America. The majestic elm trees of America were wiped out by a blight. The chestnut trees that used to line every parkway, they were wiped out. Now, the chestnut might be coming back, and some of the elms did survive in isolated areas, but this is not the first time this has happened, and we're going to essentially lose the ash tree, except in locations where the beetle doesn't get to. The only thing we can do is to cut down and destroy infested trees. And there is a treatment for it, but it is a chemical treatment. Now, this is where I veer away from being, you know, totally kosher in my organic sensibilities. And you have to have what's called common sense pest control. What they do is they inject the tree itself with like a giant syringe. And this puts a systemic insecticide. It's a chemical insecticide, but it stays inside the tree. The insecticide destroys both the larva, and if the treatment is done on a regular basis, it's been a while since I researched this, but I believe you only have to get the treatment every couple of years.
Okay.
And then the adult beetles that try to feed on the canopy next spring will also be killed. You can look this up. Go to the Pennsylvania State Extension website and read a couple of the bulletins on the emerald ash borer, because they'll have all the details. But yeah, unfortunately, it costs a fortune to take trees down. But, you know, the truth is, if a lot of your trees are infested, it will be cheaper to get rid of them all at once than to have somebody come out with a crane over and over again every couple of years. It's just a terrible situation. I wish I had better news for you.
Yeah. I mean, some of them I'd kind of be glad to get rid of, because then maybe I'll get grass growing where there wasn't any grass. But
you know, it's a sin, but that's what my neighbors found out after Sandy, is they had really never experienced sunlight on their property. They lost a third of their trees, and they were mourning it, but they really now enjoy the areas that get sun.
Right. Right. Okie dokie.
All right. Good luck, Judy.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. This is John in Westchester, PA.
All right, just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for you, sir?
Two questions, and the first question answered itself in the time I waited to place this this message. So the second question is, what do we do about really anemic growth of grass underneath dense shade trees?
Well, you know, first of all, satisfy my curiosity. What was the first question?
The first question was, we had also anemic flower bed growth this year, but that has taken care of itself. They have come back with a vengeance. We've watered, and we think we just actually planted them a little too late. It was like the 1st of June, and they really should have probably gone on the ground May 1st.
Okay, yeah, that's not the worst you could have done, which would be like July or August. But yeah, summer is a bad time for planting. And maybe they just needed time to get established. We had some wacky weather. If you go in the woods, you see there is no grass. There are several elements preventing grass from establishing well underneath multiple trees. Now, you often see when people have what's called a specimen tree, that's just one tree sitting in the middle of a beautiful lawn, that
right.
The lawn can get away with that, because if you think about it, the heaviest shade is during the summer, when cool season grasses that we grow here in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, they suffer the most. So a single tree, if the grass is managed correctly, you can often coexist with grass. But when you got multiple trees, you got two things happening. You have the dense shade that you're noticing. Use Superman's X-ray vision and look underneath the soil line. There's no soil down there. It's all tree roots. And the roots are all interconnecting. There's this giant web of life underneath. But those roots are bullies, and they're getting all the water and all the nutrients. So you have nothing going for the grass. So there is one type of grass that does the best in shade, but it still needs about 4 hours of sun a day, which is not a lot because you consider that the sun comes up and down, east to west, angles over. If you get that much or you start to kiss that much, what you can do is when we get to the fall, you can have a nice load of topsoil and compost delivered, and you can sow what's called a fine fescue. Now, fescue is a large genus. It's a large family of grasses. Most people grow what's called a turf-type tall fescue, which is possibly the most environmentally sound lawn you can grow. But that needs sun. The fine fescues, chewing fescue, red fescue, I think maybe sheep fescue is another one in there. But a complete shade mix would combine all of the fine fescues. And these make a nice lawn from a distance, which is how lawns are supposed to be viewed. But as the name implies, they are fine. They're not as thick-bladed as grasses that get full sun. And they don't take a lot of foot traffic. But they are your best bet in heavy shade. And like I would establish them in a bed that is at least 2 inches of new soil.
Wow.
Because this way, at least for the establishing time, you're not fighting the roots of the trees.
Right.
They would have a little bit of soil to go through before they got down to the next level. And if you want to pursue this path, I wouldn't even take out your old lawn. If you're committed to this, I would just start scalping it. This is one time where you really do want to see dirt blowing out the back of the motor. Just scalp it all through August. When you get to the end of August, have that topsoil compost delivered, spread it as deep as you can, and sow the fine fescue into it. And then the first season, your biggest job is going to be dealing with the leaves from those trees. So you want to be ready with a leaf blower that has a reverse setting, and you want to be out there just about every day, walking around fairly gently if you can, but getting those leaves up so they don't smother the young grass. You really want to be diligent about that, because after the leaf fall is over, that's when that grass is going to get the most sun. There's still going to be a good number of hours of daylight. The grass likes those cool temperatures of fall, and that's when it's going to get established. And then, you know, it's still going to get a lot of sunshine in the spring. So by the time your canopy is filled out, your grass is going to have the best possible start it can. So that's your best bet if you want to pursue grass. If you want to look at a more bizarre option, you would acidify the soil and you would actually start growing moss out there. I don't know if you have moss in your lawn currently.
Behind the shed, where on the north side where the sun never shines, occasionally, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So you could take that moss. If you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on Garden Answers A to Z and go to moss, there's instructions on how you can establish a moss lawn, which is green all year. You never have to feed it, and you never have to mow it. It looks like grass from the street. So that's the least work, and that's what would happen in nature. Nature in this situation, moss would naturally establish, because where you live, you have naturally acidic soil. You got a lot of shade. Yep. All you'd have to do is keep the moss moist while it's establishing, and it should be good to go.
Awesome. Appreciate your time and your advice.
Thank All right. Sir. Good luck, John.
Take care, Mike. Bye-bye.
Layla, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for taking my call. I will be absolutely ecstatic if you can solve my mystery.
All right. Okay? Where are you, Layla?
I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. I live in a very tree-covered area, very green, and I have a very confused Yoshino cherry tree.
Okay. That's the flowering ornamental cherry that lines the banks of the Potomac in Washington.
The very one.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two or three in this area, and they all bloom beautifully. But my cherry tree, I think you've heard the expression, putting the cart before the horse. Well, it puts the leaf out before it blooms.
Mm-hmm.
We thought after the first year that it was something to do with the temperature or the climate. 10 or 12 years later, it's still leafing out, and then a very sparse bloom comes on later.
Okay, but so, there is a bloom.
There are blooms, not very many, though.
Okay. You said the neighboring trees are fully flowered.
Well, they're up in the front of the property, and this is sort of midway toward the back.
Okay. Do the blooms look the same, even though there are fewer of them?
Yes.
Okay. And you say that you have trees up front that do well, and this one, the straggler, is in the back?
Yes. Probably about four houses between the two.
Okay. And is your tree in the shade?
No, not completely. It probably gets 8 hours of sun a day.
No, that should be enough. How long has it been in the ground?
About 12 years.
And it's never put on a good show for you?
Never has. We purchased the tree as a memorial for the president of our condominium association and had it planted for us. And then each year we think, oh, this will be the year, but I've given up on it. So unless there's some magic dust to sprinkle around it.
Actually, there is. That's exactly what there is. It's called rock phosphate, and it is a mined mineral. There are mountains of natural phosphorus placed throughout the globe, and they mine it. And it's a powdered rock dust. Rock dust goes back 100 years as a great way to remineralize your soil and put back the minerals that are missing from it. And because it is a rock dust, it takes a while to get activated. So you're going to get the rock phosphate, but first I have two or three more questions to ask you. Is the tree mulched?
Yes, as a lawn service would do it.
Right, so it's got a volcano around it.
Right, right.
Okay, that has to come off, or the tree not only won't bloom, but it might die. Remove the mulch. Don't let them... Oh, but you're in a condo association. You might not have any rights as to how your trees look.
Yes, we have a board who works very diligently with the lawn service, and we can do that. We can have them do whatever needs to be done.
Good. If you have to, and I know the lawn service won't like this, but the only reason they volcano mulch these trees is they get to charge you for more mulch. It's a slow, painful death to the trees. You never see a tree mulch like that in the woods.
Yeah, right.
So get that awful mulch away from the base and hope that the bark hasn't rotted. And then what you would do is you would get a bag of rock phosphate. It won't be big. You don't need a lot. For a 12-year-old cherry tree, I would say half a cup to a cup maximum. And you would just spread it around in a circle about a foot away from the trunk, and then you would cover it with topsoil or compost. If you leave it just on the surface of the soil, it'll take forever to get bioactivated. But when you cover it with compost or soil, it starts to work its way down into the root system. And if you get that mulch out of there, you get the rock phosphate down, and you put some compost or topsoil on top, I think you will see, as long as you get as much sun as you're saying, I think you'll see a decent amount of blooms next year, but guaranteed a year after that. If you don't get good blooms a year after that, take the tree out. But I think the rock phosphate will probably do the job.
Okay. This is, I'm so delighted. I'll get on with this right away.
All right.
And see what we can do. Thank you so much, Mike.
My pleasure. Good luck.
I love your show here.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I have tickets to see Bruce Springsteen on Broadway. Na-na-na-na-na-na. Well, I do. And I will personally perform on Tuesday, October 23rd in beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. However, I will not do Rosalita, probably. But don't go checking the Mike's Events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with a possible mea culpa about grass clippings and more of your culpable phone calls.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, am I going to back off my stance on grass clippings? Am I possibly going to say it's okay to collect them and use them as a garden mulch? You won't want to miss the startling answer to that question. And you won't, because it's coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Greg, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Greg. Where are you, man?
I'm about 10 minutes north of Newark, Delaware, just over the line in Cecil County, Maryland.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a grapevine problem. About 3 years ago, I planted some grapevines, a couple grapevines, and I got them from a reputable grower who's actually one of your sponsors, so I know their quality material.
Okay, good.
You know, they grew well the first 2 years, of course, no grapes, but this year I was thrilled to see grape clusters appearing on the vines. Up until about, I'd say 3 weeks ago, the grapes started to turn black and shrivel up.
Right.
And I got some spots on the leaves, and not sure, you know, I'm an organic gardener, so I'm not sure what's going on with it, and if there's an organic solution. So I'd like to hear what you have to say.
You're an organic gardener, but you might not have researched the care of grapevines, which is largely cultural and has little to do with sprays of any kind. When you put the vines into the ground, you've established some sort of trellising system to keep them up in the air, right?
Right. They're next to a fence that's already there.
Oh, okay. Now, after their second year, have you been pruning them back in the late summer and early spring?
Well, they came with a little tip sheet, and I've been following that as best as I can interpret it. I think I have.
Greg, I just asked you a direct question. Have you been pruning them every winter or early spring?
I'm not sure I've been doing it right, but I have been pruning them, yes.
Now, the really bumper question. As the leaves and the grape clusters form, have you been removing leaves and excess clusters to make sure that the vine isn't overgrown and to make sure there's airflow getting through?
No, I have not done that. No.
Ding, ding, ding. No. Why do you think in the parts of the world where grape cultivation for wine originated, why do you think they have so many recipes for grape leaves?
I imagine they take a lot of them off their vines, I guess.
Grapes are highly sensitive to being crowded. The opposite or the corollary of that is they're also incredibly lush plants. Now, you're not feeding them anything, are you?
I just put some organic leaf compost around the bottoms.
Okay, that's fine. Don't give them any kind of fertilizer, though. You don't want to encourage them. And especially even out in Northern California, where the finest wine grapes are grown in America. I'll also say yes, in Washington State. I hear you yelling at me now. You have excellent cabs and merlots as well. But they very deliberately starve the vines. They keep them in poor soil. They actually use cover crops to absorb nutrients. You get your best grapes from, and raspberries as well, from poor soil. But the secret to getting good grapes, so the bad news is you learned this a little too late for this season. The good news is there's nothing wrong, and there's every reason to believe you're going to get fabulous harvests in the future, is once the leaves and the clusters start really filling out and just enveloping the plant, you want to be out there, you want to remove about half the leaves. You want there to be room. Just imagine yourself as an air current. You want to be able to move in between the leaves. You want to be able to wick moisture off of every leaf surface. Mm. And you want to remove probably about a third of the developing grape clusters. I know it seems terrible. I know it seems like a waste. Oh, my God, this is this whole thing of grapes I'm not going to get. But the truth is, you get twice as many grapes if you remove a third while they're growing.
Uh-huh.
At the end of this season, it's very important you get rid of all this trash, all these discolored leaves. Don't leave any mummified grapes on the ground. Really clean it up well. Rake it out of there. Every season, I fully support you putting down a fresh inch of compost right underneath the grapevines, and that should do it. I'll just mention for people who are thinking about doing grapes, if you had grown them on a true arbor, that is a very high trellis, so to speak, with a ceiling on top that has openings on it, with a roof with panels, you know, where the grapes can come down. You don't have to do nearly as much thinning because of the airflow that design creates. But growing up a fence, you're going to have to be out there removing leaves and grape clusters. Grape clusters, you'll just compost or leave for the birds. The grape leaves, learn how to use them. They are they're an integral part of many great cultural dishes.
Great. Well, I'm thrilled. I thought the vine was done for the way it looks, so I'm glad to hear that there's still future.
Absolutely normal and probably the biggest cause of this kind of problem.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Good luck, man. Lisa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for taking my call. I am in Worcester, Pennsylvania.
All right. What can we do for Lisa in Worcester?
I'm calling with a request for advice on how to treat apple trees who have succumbed to a cedar apple rust.
Ooh, that's a tough one.
We planted about 6 trees between August and October of 2017. And right as they began to bud in the spring, I started noticing a little bit of a rust color on them. Did a little digging, a little bit of research, and figured that it was cedar apple rust. All of the information that I read on the disease was that it would turn the leaves brown, but it shouldn't impact your fruit production so long as you continued to use an organic mulch and potentially spray with neem oil in the fall and then again before it budded in the spring. Unfortunately, our trees began to die. So my husband sprayed them with a fungicide. I know it's terrible, but they're bouncing back. We have new growth. But what can I do going forward to treat them?
Well, as you probably learned from your own research, this is a curious condition that travels back and forth between cedar and juniper trees and shrubs and apples. It overwinters, it survives on the host of the cedar and juniper, and then it affects the apple trees. But as you also said, it's supposed to be only cosmetic. Now, your apple trees are very young. How did you select the varieties? Did you go for any kind of disease resistance?
We did not. When we bought our home in July of last year, there were 2 very mature apple trees and a very mature pear tree. So we just went out and bought a couple different varieties. We have Macintosh, we have Dwarf Pink Lady, we have Liberty, Mutsu. We did a number of varieties, and they all succumbed to the cedar apple rust.
Yeah, that's a good lesson for everybody. In the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast, it is very difficult to grow apples and peaches. Forget about organically, even conventionally. There are a lot of pests and diseases to protect them from. So the first thing you want to look at, it's not like a racehorse. You don't want to fall in love with a name. You want to look at trees that are known to be resistant to various stresses. And it's tough because you don't really know what the stress is going to be. But clearly you have a lot of juniper plantings in your area. Are any of them on your property?
Yes. So my mother-in-law pointed out after the trees began to show signs that we do have a very large juniper tree about 50 feet away from where we planted our little orchard.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. Your trees are new, and it sounds like you've been raising them organically except for that one spray?
Yes.
And they're nice mulch of compost on the ground?
Yes, we just did it last week again.
Okay, good. I would suggest that your best bet, I mean, you're fighting Muhammad Ali with that giant juniper right nearby. But there is an all-around prevention for apples and peaches and other fruit trees called Surround. I don't know if you've heard me talk about it. It is a clay spray. When you get it, it'll be a fine white powder like flour, and you put it into a sprayer. You mix it with the recommended amount of water. You keep that well shaken up, and you spray it on your trees, even in your case before bud break. What it'll do is it'll flock them like an old-fashioned Christmas tree. They'll get like a silvery, whitish-gray covering on them. So it looks kind of weird, but that actually prevents the disease spores from landing on the leaves or the branches of your apple tree.
Okay.
And it's very protective against insects as well as a wide range of diseases.
Okay.
Your only other realistic choice is to choose between apples and that giant juniper, but it sounds like it would cost a fortune to take the juniper down.
Well, my husband's very handy, and I don't want to get the idea of him taking the tree down in his head, because he would.
Yeah, Now, your other option is to watch the trees as they grow, and you can cull out the most affected ones. And then as time goes by, take a look, read up on the disease-resistant varieties, and see if there are some proven varieties that are out there that show a great resistance to cedar apple rust, and replant with those. It's not the worst option. My
right.
suggestion is get the surround, get a good backpack sprayer. They're great to have around. You need it if you have fruit trees, and just keep those trees covered. And you should certainly get some nice apples out of the deal. You shouldn't see the disease as prevalent as it was.
Okay, great. That's really good to know. I was very worried. All right, great. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we're calling using grass clippings as mulch. Brett Rader, now fully embellished producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's question.
Hold on. That's the title of this week? After 19 years and 10 months on the air, you suddenly decide to change your mind about grass clippings?
Just read the question, Brett.
I can't. My head is spinning. I mean, I see poor little lawns starving, fatal compost being created, green slimy masses of woe-begotten mulch.
You know, kid, that mulch won't be the only woe-begotten thing around here if you don't get on to this question.
Okay. Joel in Elkton, Maryland writes, "My stomach churned when I read your comments that grass clippings should always be shredded and returned to the turf with a mulching lawnmower. I am new to an acre and a half of lawn and just purchased a very expensive bagger attachment for an equally expensive zero-turn mower with the intent of using the collected clippings as a 1 to 3 inch layer of mulch in my vegetable garden."
Now, this is a really long question, so I'm going to jump in and break things up a bit. First, clippings from an untreated lawn do make an excellent mulch. In a test we ran at the Rodale Institute back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, dried grass clippings prevented weed growth, retained soil moisture, and were judged to be the most attractive mulch, nicer looking than straw, compost, shredded leaves, or wood. The drying part is important. Fresh clippings must be spread out to dry until they're tannish brown before being used as a mulch, or they'll get all slimy. Now, come on, back to the question.
All right. Well, Joel goes all mad science on us. Quote, "Grass mulch has a seemingly beneficial mix of solid-to-air volume fraction, especially the high volume of air. Compared to wood mulch, this larger amount of void space provides less resistance to air and water vapor transport, thereby allowing the soil to breathe while still blocking weeds. I also suspect that grass mulch allows beneficial insects to flourish, while minimizing the presence of roly-polies, pill bugs, or whatever you call them. The surface roughness of the outward-facing grass mulch may also prevent water from splashing back up onto the plant."
Which would help lower disease pressures, but not nearly as much as a mulch of compost, as some of the organisms in well-made compost actually eat disease spores. Oh, and roly-poly, sow bug, pill bug thingies are not plant enemies. They just recycle plant debris at the soil line.
Joel continues, "I have contemplated two potentially harmful impacts of using grass mulch, but they are specific to certain plants. One would be increasing thermal resistance that would keep the roots of heat-loving veggies, like melons and eggplant, cooler than their optimal growing temperature. The other is providing an environment for verticillium, fusarium, and other harmful microorganisms to flourish."
Well, that first part depends on the season. If summer turns out to be cool and cloudy, keeping the roots cool would be a problem. But if it's heat wave after heat wave, cool soil could be a blessing. And those two diseases he mentions are both soil-borne wilts. They have no connection to any kind of mulch.
Oh boy, this guy must buy ink by the barrel, because he continues, "I would like your input on the hypotheses I have presented. As you may have guessed, I am a scientist and would like to test my claims of increased air vapor transport, decreased radiative transport, relative insect population affect, water rebound, increased thermal resistance, and the proliferation of unwanted microorganisms. But for now, please help me feel more comfortable about my recent purchase. I'd even be willing to compromise and alternate between mulching and collecting grass when I mow."
All right, Is he done?
I think so. I'm afraid to look.
All right. Now, most of his hypotheses are actually sound, and dried grass clippings do make an excellent mulch. I would especially consider their use in areas where fall leaves are not abundant and the making of compost is challenging.
But the clippings must be from a no-nonsense, herbicide-free lawn, and the clippings must be spread out to dry first. But, Mike, are you really changing your religion?
Nah, I saved the best for last. Back in 1995, researchers at the Rodale Institute analyzed grass clippings for their nutrient content. 1 acre of clippings yielded 235 pounds of nitrogen, the primary grass food, 77 pounds of phosphorus, and 210 pounds of potassium. That's about half the yearly recommended feeding for the average lawn.
Right. Collect the clips and you'll starve the turf. Oh, but he just bought that $1 million mower.
Yeah, but if he keeps the blade super sharp and he doesn't let the grass get too tall between cuttings, he can mulch those nutrient-rich clippings back into the lawn without any harm. And since it does seem to be his garden mulch of choice, he can certainly bag 1 or 2 runs a year. That should be more than enough to supply a nice 2-inch layer over the average garden. Well, that sure was a somewhat dizzying discussion about grass clippings, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over at our leisure, your leisure, or our leisure, either way, just check the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week, and you will always find the latest question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Yikes! My producer is threatening to bag my clippings if I don't get out of the studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are absolutely certain we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks, and our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and stay current with the show at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website well-mowed. Sartorial Al Banks is our editor. Our former associate producer of Production Association and now our official producer is Brett Rader. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I just found out that 1 million of you download our podcast every year. Sweet! Maybe I will sing Rosalita after all. Then again, maybe not. But I will see you again next week.